Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Again, the great Frank Robinson passed away today. What a ball player. Oh, could throw, could run, could hit, hit with power. He could do it all. And I thought was a very good manager in his time. Very good manager. He never had a lot to work with, but I always felt like he got the most out of it. First ever MVP in both leagues in 61 and 66. Triple crown winner in 66. 83 years old. What a player. He really transformed the Orioles when they picked him up. They, you know, they were able to build around him with Boog Powell and Brooks Robinson and Paul Blair and Andy Etchebarren and, you know, eventually Merv Rettenmund, Dave McNally, Jim Palmer. Then they acquired Mike Cuellar from the Astros, and then they got Pat Dobson, and they had Eddie Watts. But when they got Robinson, that changed everything for them. Changed everything. All right, we're going to talk recruiting in a few moments with Ryan Snyder, but first, our play-by-play call of the day.
Gardner has it again. Got it ahead, but it was intercepted. Matthews brings it right back in with speed on the wing, trying to drag it in front of the goal. Shoots it, scores! How's the new contract? Not bad.
Austin Matthews, the American, making a big difference in Canada. Yeah, Austin Matthews, a Phoenix, Arizona kid. And he just signed that new contract extension with the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's interesting how the bonus money plays out as to the regular contract on taxes. Because the tax bill in Canada is a little high. It's a little high. It's amazing how that works. Okay, let's get to recruiting now. Yesterday was the late signing period. It's actually not done. There's still one big name out there. Let's bring in Ryan Snyder from Rivals.com and Blue White Illustrated. Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Oh, it was more than a good portion. You could tell he wanted to talk about that yesterday, which I really enjoyed. I thought he was great talking about that and being realistic about the whole situation. It's a lot of questions that fans have too, because, you know, just talk about guys in the locker room and, you know, do they still practice and whatnot. I thought James was great yesterday when discussing that.
Yeah, and I did as well because I thought it was informative. It's a guessing game for everybody right now. Mm-hmm. I think that's the part about this is that there are so many unintended consequences that I don't think anybody knows yet how to really have a handle and a grip on this thing. I think that would be mm-hmm. fair to say.
It's kind of similar to the early signing period, late signing period too. I mean, that's we're still working out the kinks with that. You know, we've talked about that a bunch of times, but it'll be an interesting couple of years here to see how both of these play out.
All right, let's start with the recruiting part. First of all, Penn State had already done the bulk of it, 19 signed players in December, back on the 20th, 21st, whatever it was, right around that time. So in this late signing period, how did they do on need to fill the class out?
Yeah, four big additions, all of which are at positions of need. I think, you know, a lot of people have been looking along the defensive line and adding two quality guys, Smith-Vilbert, out of New Jersey, a big defensive end, you know, has a lot of length and whatnot. You know, still pretty raw, but he's only really played a year and a half of football, to be honest. But shows a lot of potential there. Of course, Sean Spencer would love to get his hands on him. And then talk about raw, Joseph Darkwa out of Germany. Yes, Germany. That's going to be so much fun to watch. First off, great kid. you know, he's talked to me before about how he never really watched football, and I think he watched The Longest Yard, I think it was, and that, you know, that really got him into it. You know, now he's always watching different YouTube videos and whatnot. You know, he just loves the sport. You know, still pretty raw, but it actually, Jane said yesterday, he's a little more advanced than people would think, but obviously this is going to be a whole different level for him. So big adds there on the defensive line, and then T.J. Jones, a really solid wide receiver out of Florida, plays big-time football in Florida, too, which I think people need to understand. He's playing at the highest level, played for a team that earned a number one seed as well. They actually upset IMG Academy during the preseason. I know it was only a preseason game, but anyone that knows anything about IMG, they are basically a super school that recruit from not only just Florida and the region, but the entire country. So to see an actual high school with, you know, district boundaries and all that that can only pull from a couple hundred square miles or whatnot to beat a school like IMG is just that really stands out to me. A lot of there, and he had a big part in that. And then the final guy is Daquan Hardy, an athlete out of Penn Hills. Daquan's not a big guy. He's probably 5'8", 5'9". We have him at 5'10", but let's be honest, he's probably closer to 5'8", 5'9". But listen, this kid, anyone that watched the PIAA 5A game knows what this kid is all about. Does a little bit of everything. Penn State has him listed as an athlete on their official roster. James said yesterday he'll probably start at corner, which makes sense. You know, Terry Smith had a big hand in this, and I give Terry a lot of credit. Schools were worried about his size, and it's a fair thing to, you know, to look at, but this kid's incredible, man. Had over 10 interceptions this season alone. I think he'll really play well in the slot, you know, matching up against guys like K.J. Hamler. I know they're on the same team, but there's going to be plenty of other K.J.'s throughout the league. I'd put him in the slot and let him do his thing, and, you know, obviously he's got to add some weight, but he's a heck of a player.
All right, and let's get to the next part. This isn't finished, especially when it comes to one particular guy.
It's not? Oh, man. this was my Christmas, man. I thought we were done. No, I'm just kidding, of course. Yes, there is one big fish still out there, and it crossed the top 100 safety. Out of DeMatha, I'll be real. I have no idea what's happening. I don't even think Penn State knows. It has been a I don't want to call it a circus because that's not fair for me to say, but it's been a lot of rumors, a lot of guessing, and right now it appears as if he's going to end up in the Big Ten. He was committed to Florida State for a while. Seems like family and mentors feel like it's best for him to stay closer to home. Maryland is certainly in the mix, and Penn State is also a big player here, too. Do I know where he's going to end up? I have no idea. I've spent all day trying to figure out little hints here and there, and you know, whenever I hear one thing, I hear the opposite about 20 minutes later. So I don't think there's a recruiting reporter out there that can truly tell you where he's going to end up and when he's going to end up making a decision. But just keep in mind that there is a big fish to add. And if they do get him, it will give Penn State the number one class in the Big Ten because they are just right behind Michigan right now by a couple points. When he's going to decide, though, I wish I could give you an answer.
All right, so now with that waiting game, he is going to give, for example, the staff some time off, which they've earned. But they've also laid a great foundation for 2020. So, Ryan, it's a question that you asked in the press conference yesterday. Everything goes in cycles. What's the sense that you get on the Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey cycle for 2020?
Yeah, it's very good, especially Maryland. New Jersey is very stacked as well. The last 2 years, Penn State's had to really go outside the region. That's why we're seeing guys from Florida and Texas and whatnot. And that was good for Penn State. That's great for Penn State, the fact that they have laid some roots there. But don't get me wrong, I'm sure they'll be hitting that area, you know, in 2020 and 2021. But the region is much more interesting, especially in 2020. Just I think we have 4 or 5 stars alone. Of course, Julian Fleming, everyone knows about. Marshawn Lloyd, the top running back out of DeMatha. There's a few more throughout the region, but it's really just stacked with top 250 guys. I mean, there's, I believe it's 25, 30, maybe even a little bit more. To have that just in our immediate region is a pretty good number. You usually see Florida and Texas with bigger numbers. So to have 30 plus, I think it might even be close to 40. I think it's around 35, I want to say. That's pretty good compared to what we've seen in recent years. So they have definitely laid the groundwork. Of course, they got two commitments over the weekend for 2020 and Curtis Jacobs and Josh Moten. Jacobs will probably play linebacker, listed as an athlete, but I expect him to grow into a linebacker. And Moten is a heck of a cornerback. So already up to four commitments now in 2020. And they maybe the biggest move of the weekend was the 2021 pickup, which is Dante Thornton out of Baltimore. They're all three of the commitments, by the way, were out of Baltimore. But you know, Thornton is going to be a heck of a player. You know, he's still not ranked and all that, only a sophomore, but a lot of people think he's going to be one of the best receivers in the region in 2021. So it was a great junior day over the weekend, and they'll build on that in the coming weeks and months when they have more junior days and personal visits to come.
College basketball will end up between 600 and 800 transfers per year. It's been really in the 700 to 800 area per year for the last, let's say, 3 years. College football, if you put FCS and FBS together, the portal, as he mentioned yesterday, was 1,789. I think 500-plus of them are FCS. The rest are FBS. How close now do you have to follow that part? Because, in essence, that is also recruiting.
Yeah, and that's a big number. You know that. And James said that the other day. That is a big, big number. So for the last couple of weeks, I'll be honest, Nate, my coworker, you guys, of course, know Nate Bauer. He's been out a little bit more than me. This has been one of the busier January periods I've had in a while. You know, even before the early signing period, Penn State's been wrapped up much more in recent years than what they were this year. And a big part of that, of course, was because of the transfers. They had to add a few more guys than what I thought it would have been back in, you know, early December. So far, you know, I know that, you know, it's clear they're going to want an offensive lineman, probably a wide receiver, probably a defensive tackle, maybe even a few at those positions, possibly especially with O-line, D-line. But exactly who they're looking at and whatnot, we haven't seen any visits yet. You know, I think that's about to come. We do know Virginia Tech wide receiver Eric Kuma is going to come up in April. But that's what's interesting about this is some of these guys are going to want to get it wrapped up here soon. Other ones we've talked to, you know, are saying, hey, you know, hit me up in the summertime. I'll worry about it then. So, you know, Penn State thinks that, or fans think that Penn State is going to have this wrapped up in the near future. It doesn't look that way. I think this is going to drag all the way out till probably June, hopefully done by June, maybe even into July.
And if somebody wants to be a grad transfer, they may not have their degree yet.
Correct.
And that won't happen until after the spring semester is over with. For some, not mm-hmm. all, but for some guys. And that also has to be taken into account.
Big part of it. Big part of it. I know his last name is Abercrombie. He's from a Rice defensive tackle. I forget his first name. I want to say Zach Abercrombie. But he's a grad transfer looking at Penn State and a bunch of big-time schools. Had a decent season down at Rice. Rice didn't have many positives this year, but he was one of them. So he's a name to keep an eye on. But, again, you know, he's another guy that's saying, you know, talk to me in June. As of right now, I'm just focused on getting my degree, and we'll worry about all that then.
Wouldn't be the first ever Rice transfer here. Jimmy Shaw transferred from
Rice.
Yeah,
I learned that the other day, actually. Someone told me about that.
Yep. Okay. So now when you put the recruiting puzzle together, what are the dynamics now with the combination of transfers, portals, recruits? How do you try to now weave that puzzle together as a publication to give everybody an accurate view about where things might be?
It's trial and error, honestly. I mean, you know, the transfer thing is just so new. You know, I mean, recruiting, I've got it down pat. We're doing it long enough. Know the coaches and everything. But with the transfers, it's a lot of trial and error. You know, a lot of these guys have been through the media process so much now where they don't really want to talk. You know, at the same time, you know, you used to be able to go to high school coaches, and high school coaches would help navigate that. Now they're not really involved that much. You know, that now that this is all public and in the portal, it's more so the player and their parents. So some of them are open to talking about the situation. Others are just going to keep it, you know, as quiet as possible. So, you know, you try and work with contacts, you know, up at Penn State. Of course, some things are okay to talk about, other things aren't. And, you know, you just try and figure out what's kosher and what's not. But this is new for me. It's new for a lot of people. And, you know, I don't see a good rotation or really digging out the process anytime soon, unless they make the transfer portal public, which I don't see that happening.
Right. Will you now feel like you have to keep it, like, for example, let's take this recruiting class. Will you keep that database intact, especially if you have family contacts? Just, you know, and for whatever it happens to be, whatever team it happens to be, keep the database if they have to recontact them.
Exactly, yes. But one thing we're also finding is the recruiting process is so grueling that guys are just changing their numbers, you know, because, and it is so much. I mean, this is one thing I've talked to you about. I understand why guys want to sign early and get it out of the way, because the recruiting media is just as grueling as all the coaches calling. I've had a lot of guys tell me that, and you know, that's something that myself and the other guys that cover Penn State, we take pride in, because we understand that, and we do everything we can to work with the families and whatnot. Especially, you know, when they're 2.5 years in, it is a lot. But yeah, of course, we'll keep all those numbers, and Rivals has a great database. I'm sure 247 and all the other you know, services have something similar. But a lot of these guys, man, once they get to college, they change those numbers because they are you know, just need a fresh start. And you know, when you have 24 media reporters that have your number, they just, you got to change it up, which I understand. It makes sense.
If it gets to August, if they ever move the early signing date to August, how tough will it be for the guys that didn't sign in terms of having so many people descend upon them for months?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I hope it does move to August. I'm a proponent for that. I think that's what where it should go. I think right before the season makes sense.
Yep.
It just depends. You know, if you look back this year, Penn State would have been around, I think the number was 15 or so, which is about a little more than half the class. We'll say two-thirds or so. It will be more grueling for the guys that don't. They will get additional schools, but it will be good for the two-star, three-star guys, the guys that you know, maybe didn't get all the attention. They will get bumped up then, you know, to maybe some bigger schools. So it just depends on the prospect. If you're an elite prospect that already had 40 plus offers and you wait it all out, it's going to be a lot. You need to be prepared for that. But if you are someone like, we'll say Daquan Hardy, for example, a really good player who then has an awesome senior season, you can really benefit from that. So it works both ways. It really just depends on the player and even to the high school that they're at and how much attention they get. There's so many different factors that play into that. One thing I will say is that the guys that wait now for January, those 3 weeks, I would never want to go through that if I was a parent, put it that way, because that is on a different level than I think even most of these guys understand. They go through it, and I haven't talked to too many that said, yeah, I kind of wish I would have signed, because a lot of those guys are just out of it after those final couple weeks.
See, that's why I'd like, actually, that's the reason I'd like to see the early one go to August, because I think now it gives a little more breathing room for the guys that sign late.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the way it will be moved. You know, they did December, I think, because of they didn't want to work out. They wanted to work out the kinks, kind of like what we were saying with the transfer portal. It's going to take some time. That's why they only moved it up a little bit. They didn't want guys to get totally screwed over, and especially if coaching changes and whatnot. That's just the thing they have to figure out, how to handle guys with coaching changes. Once they figure that whole process out, I don't see any reason why they shouldn't move it to August.
The only thing I would do with coaching changes would involve the head coach.
Mm-hmm. It gets tricky with the assistants.
Right? Okay, when you start doing the coordinator part and so forth, I mean, that to me is, you know, now we're just looking for any excuse to get out. If it's the head coach, where you're really almost assured of staff turnover with one or two exceptions, okay, now I'm on board with that rule. But if it's my position coach left, well, I'm sure the other guy comes in, there's a reason why they hired him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, hang in there. You'll be all right.
And all to right. add to that real quick, that's why Penn State goes about things the way they do, where they have an offensive player talk to the entire offensive staff and vice versa. They make sure everybody's comfortable. And it's a big reason why they're having the success they are. There's a lot of other schools that haven't caught up to that yet. And it's a matter of time till they do, because it's a big reason why Penn State's having the success they are.
Yeah, he's always had the entire staff involved in recruiting a player, not just the position coach, not just it's your recruiting region. It's always been, by the time you're done being recruited at Penn State, you know the all 10 assistant coaches and the head coach and the staff and the trainer and the strength and conditioning group. They're all there the entire time with you.
It's a great way to approach it. It's the new school way, and it's the smart way.
It's a smart way. Ryan, thanks so much. Appreciate your time, because I know you've been awfully busy.
This is my Christmas, by the way. Everyone thinks signing day is my Christmas. This is my Christmas.
Yes, that's exactly right. Try and put your feet up at least for 10 minutes and then go back to work.
Yeah, Nick's Cross is messing that up for me a bit. So. Okay. Have a good day, guys. Take care.
That's Ryan Snyder, Rivals.com, Blue White Illustrated. Sweetie Murdy, next half hour as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Basketball tonight, Penn State and Ohio State. Then we'll have Jeff Byers on the show here in Columbus tomorrow to preview Penn State-Ohio State wrestling. Looking forward to that and getting Jeff on the show again in a dual meet that probably will be decided by bonus points. That's how close everyone expects it to be. All right, baseball rule changes. There are a few that are possibly on the horizon. Last night on MLB Network, Ron Darling, John Smoltz, Brian Kenny, and Sweeney Murdy sat down and discussed all of this. And Sweeney now joins us, courtesy of WFAN in New York. Hello, Sweeney. Great to have you back with us.
Steve, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I really, really enjoy getting a chance to hear you every now and again on the satellite as I'm driving around all fall and winter. And it's a pleasure to chat with you now.
All right, let's get to some of the topics that were brought up last night, because this goes with some of the rules that were floated out there that are there at least a consideration or talking points, whatever they may be. Let's start with Universal DH for both leagues. Universal DH, look, I remember when the first DH, Ron Bloomberg, came up. So it's been over. I mean, look, it's been forever. 45 plus years now that this rule has been in play in the American League. Obviously, you're covering an American League team every day. DH, no DH.
Full DH. And you're talking to somebody who grew up in the Harrisburg area and watched Phillies baseball growing up. So I watched National League ball. And, you know, growing up, it was all about, yeah, love National League ball. I've watched the Yankees pretty much every day for the last 18, going on 19 years now. And not just that, Steve, but when you combine the fact that when I watch pitchers hit, I just realize how bad they are at it. And it's really not fun it's not enjoyable, it's not entertaining in any way to watch them do it at the professional level. Pitchers are not asked to hit after high school. There's a DH in every professional league, and you end up in interleague games now asking the American League pitchers to hit for the first time in forever. Even the National League pitchers who do it on a regular basis, they just aren't good enough at it to make it something that needs to be done for the sake of tradition. A lot of sports have evolved over the years, different things, different specializations. Football used to be you play both ways. Well, that stopped. There's just different things that happen in sports along the way, and I no longer find any real value in a pitcher batting for the National League. I'm over the strategy element of it. These guys don't last long enough in games anyway for it to be a major factor anymore. You're essentially pinch hitting for them the second time they come up. Well, so what difference does it make? You're losing one at bat a game, maybe two. I don't see the real impact. I feel it's one of these things that people yell and scream about it until it happens, and then nobody will care.
Pitchers hit 136 last year in the National League. Overall, they hit 136. DH has hit 249 last year. Look, and the strategy part, I always love, well, there's so much more strategy. Okay,
yeah.
Runner on first, nobody out. Pitcher's up. I think he might punt, Sweeney. So much for playing along with the manager.
Oh, my gosh. It's, you know, and listen, and, you know, do you remember, you know, how many highlight reels have you seen of managers thinking? You know, I mean, I get it, you know, and I enjoy,
Sure. Listen,
I've been around baseball a long time now, and I enjoy talking to people about the game and thinking about the game, you know, but, you know, it's, you know, nobody wakes up the next morning and says, hey, did you see that sack bunt or did you see that double switch? You know, it's really just, you know, they're talking about entertainment value, and to me there's just no entertainment value in watching a pitcher hit anymore. It's passed them by, and because they're not asked to do it. That's the thing, you know.
Right.
You get to the major leagues, and all of a sudden you're asked to hit against the best pitchers in baseball when you haven't been asked to do it since high school. It's not fair.
Right, and I'm going into my 14th season of doing the State College Spikes games here, and it, you know, they have the DH, and the Spikes are a St. Louis Cardinals affiliate.
Yeah,
they're using the DH
exactly.
At this level because they want to look at the pitcher's pitch, and they want to use the DH to evaluate a hitter.
Yeah, and
so you're not asked to do it.
I don't love the idea. I've seen two pretty significant injuries to pitchers on the base paths.
Yes.
And I don't think that that's a good enough reason in and of itself, but it's an extra benefit of it. You know, you're paying these guys now a lot of money to pitch the ball. You know, running the bases is different. I understand, you know, it's not the same thing. And I tried to tell Mr. Ron Darling yesterday, I said, you know, Masahiro Tanaka he pulled two hamstrings last year trying to tag up from third base and score on a sacrifice fly.
Right.
I thought it was a bad decision to send him because that one run wasn't worth the help of my pitcher for a month. But I find myself taking the Joes versus Pros. I was taking the Joes side here. I said, shouldn't the guy be able to just run? And Darling snapped right back at me. He said, it's different. It's not the same thing when you're trying to sprint home in a game situation like that off the bases. Running the bases is just different. And this is from a guy who played in the major leagues for a long time. I'll take his word for it.
Right, exactly. But there's another part to it as well. Mike Mussina, I think, gets into the Hall of Fame in part because he ate up a lot of innings, he won a lot of games, but he also did it in a DH league where you're not facing essentially seven hitters in the lineup, you're facing nine. And I think that's also a consideration in this.
I would even go so far as to say, like six and a half hitters, you know, that's it's the way pitchers attack the bottom of that lineup in the National League. I was a big proponent of Mussina as a Hall of Famer. I watched the final 8 years of his career with the Yankees up close. And, DH League, what he was able to do, it's certainly a big consideration there. There's, you know, just look at, Curt Schilling has a tremendous Hall of Fame case for him. But just look at the difference in his career ERA, National League to American League. It's pretty significant, and it's not a knock against Schilling and nothing to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. It's just that, you know, the American League produces more runs. And to me, this argument, Steve, isn't about producing more offense for the sake of entertainment. It's simply the fact that you're sending up these helpless people, you know, once every nine turns. What are you expecting here? It's
right.
You're just trying to get past that at bat so the next real hitter can come up. I just think that we've come to the point where it's not worth keeping around anymore.
The average time between pitches increased to an all-time high of 24.1 seconds last year. How do you feel about a 20-second pitch clock?
I'm not opposed to it. I think I think what's going to happen is it'll have an overall effect on a lot of guys because, you know, for me, Yeah, you're going to have these guys who maybe take 30 seconds trying to get to within, you know, let's say they take 25 seconds, they have to now pitch within 20. I think the guy who takes 15 to 20 seconds is still going to be just as aware of the clock, and maybe it speeds him up a few more seconds. The time between tip pitches seems to be the biggest thing, and, you know, I like the idea of the clock. I'm fine with it, and I know that there's going to be some, you know, some unintended consequences of it.
Right.
As there are any rule change, you're going to wait to see how it plays out, and then see, oh, okay, this is the way it works now. But I think that the biggest drag on the game in time is the time between pitches. And I think there's a couple of big reasons for it. When there's guys on base, it's a lot about sign stealing and trying to get the signals from the catcher to the pitcher. Yeah, I mean, that just eats up so much time. But another part of it, I think, is that, you know, I think guys are, you know, they're trying to throw every pitch as hard as they can. And when they do that, I think they're trying to conserve energy between pitches and trying to gear up for that next throw it as hard as I can fastball. And that's something that I think is you know, it's really more of the way the guys are throwing. And the pitch clock is probably necessary for that, because I just think guys are catching their breath every pitch and trying to get through it as much as they can.
The three batter minimum. You use the phrase, and I think everyone knows who listens to the show. I've talked many times on different topics about unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the three batter minimum brings with it a list of unintended consequences, which I thought the four of you did a great job of outlining last night.
One of them to me was, you know, is it strictly three batters? Because what if a guy comes in and gets a double play ball?
Right.
You know, he gets two outs facing one batter. If a guy gets picked off, does that lessen, you know, does that guy gets caught stealing?
If you get the last out of the game, do you have to face the next game, the first two batters?
But you know what? That's funny, but I just thought of this morning when I was thinking more about this rule. What if if it's two outs in the eighth inning and I bring in a pitcher if I bring in a left-hander to get the next left-hander out, he gets the third out of the inning. I now want to bring in my closer for the ninth inning. So do I now have to let the other guy pitch the first two batters of that inning, of that ninth inning, because it's a three-batter minimum? I think if we're going to implement that, the inning has to be allowed to reset. The end of the inning has to be allowed to reset that rule. It should only be, if you're going to go there, it can only be within the inning. Because even if it's not a closer situation, what if I bring a guy in to get an out, he gets one out, I have to keep him in for two more, but then my team's five runs in their turn at bat, and it changes the dynamic of who I want to pitch the rest of, you know, to the next inning. And the other thing that I think has to be fair, and I got this from a pitcher. One of my close friends in the game is a left-hander named Randy Choate, who played for years in the big league as a lefty specialist. And he says, what happens when I come in to pitch face a left-hander? What's the first thing the manager does? He pinch hits the right-hander. So this is... if you're going to enforce this pitcher has to face these batters, you can't take every advantage away from him. You have to let the announced hitter bat and at least give him that first left-on-left matchup. If you want to pinch it, you know, if you stack two lefties, you want to pinch it for the second lefty, okay, that's fair. You haven't announced the guy. That's regular rules. But if you've announced this batter coming up and then a left-handed pitcher comes in, you can't just pull him back and then send up a right-hander and make that move, which we've seen happen plenty of times.
Talking about expanding the roster to 26, I'll take it one step further. I'd like to see it be maybe 27 or 28, and here's my reasoning. No expansion to 40. Okay, don't do that. Keep it at 28 all season as a number. And I also like capping the number of pitchers on there at a dozen. How do you feel about that rule?
I feel like 26 is fine for the regular season.
Okay. I can go with that, too. That's fine.
I like their idea that they want to expand to 28 in September and kind of make it like a, or even if you expand beyond 28, you have an active 28 and it's a taxi squad type of situation, you know, or a practice squad or whatever you want to call it. Instead of this team has 39 guys and this team has 33 guys and, you know, you've got six left-handed pitchers in the bullpen and you're going to bring in one for every out from the sixth inning on, that it creates absurdities in the game, and it's not fun for anybody to go through. But, yeah, the thing I keep thinking about, though, like as we go through these rules changes, I think I brought up this point yesterday. I can't remember if it was in the meeting of the show. These guys are, you know, this is what happens when we get old, Steve. What the people are trying to do to play the game, they're just trying to win the game. They don't care how long it takes. They don't care if, you know, if it takes an extra 30 seconds to get the signal from the catcher to the pitcher to make sure I got the right pitch. They're fine with that because they have one job, it's to win the game. And that's right. You know, we're trying to make it more entertaining. And there's, you know, there has to be a balance there, no doubt about it. But the people involved in the game aren't concerned. They're trying to manipulate all the rules to their best advantage. And, you know, when we see talk about unintended consequences, that's what happens when you set down rules. People are always going to try to find a way to get around it.
Which I'll bring up something. It's not in the rules, but it's something that was used a lot this year, especially by Tampa Bay more than anybody else, and that's the opener. Brian Kenny, who is very analytics-driven, and it's not that Brian doesn't have – great points. Brian does make great points. And John Smoltz is always funny because he's the get off my lawn guy, you know. Mm-hmm. Which makes it interesting. Now, it's never pointed out that Tampa Bay's record with the opener was under 500. that never comes up. Have you noticed that? But what do you think of that? I mean, I don't mind trying something, but as an old-time baseball guy, it doesn't quite wash with me. And I just watched a team win the World Series that had legit starters.
Well, and that proves your point that, you know, you're still going to get to, you know, you're the best teams are still going to be put in the best position if they have legit starters. Tampa Bay, they've explained it to me, you know, over the course of the year, many times, really what went down. They had a lot of things happen to them that forced them into that situation.
That's right.
A lot of guys got hurt, and the people that were in line behind them, the starting depth, was all young players that probably wouldn't have survived the innings crunch that would have been forced on them if they had to keep making starts every 5 days and throw five, six, seven innings. So they had to get a little creative to save the innings number on their depth guys, because when those guys went down, they would have been searching, you know, elsewhere for pitchers, and they don't have anywhere else to go. So it was born out of necessity, not, let's figure out how we can reinvent the wheel here. And it worked to a degree for them. The team won 90 games. But remember, they also, the irony of a Cy Young Award winner in the American League, given to the best starting pitcher. And
yes.
He wasn't the guy who was pitching one or two innings. He was going out there every 5 days. But his injury earlier in the year and some innings concerns was part of the reason they needed to, you know, worry about this in all the other starts that they were dealing with. So I don't love the idea of reacting to a rule after you saw it happen one time to one extreme with one team. If it becomes a widespread problem, then okay, we can work on this and think about this. But what are you supposed to do? Force a guy to pitch a certain number? You're risking health and all kinds of other things when this happens.
Yes. Yeah, no question. And one final question, I'll let you go because I know you're really busy, and it's going to deal with the Yankees. Obviously, Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are still out there, and Jason Benetti, who does the White Sox games, he and I were talking at Shoot Around today because he's going to do the game on ESPN tonight. And obviously, Machado visited Chicago. That aside, if the Yankees make no other move, then they don't go with Harper, they don't go with Machado. They've made so many other moves during this offseason.
How impressed are you by what Brian Cashman was able to do? Because, I mean, they still won 100 games last year. It just turned out there was a buzzsaw that was in front of them.
The last 2 years, that buzzsaw has been there. And, you know, the Yankees are measured by a certain standard, but we have to remember that the last 2 years, they have lost to teams better than them during the regular season, but, you know, decisively better than them in the regular season. It's been a slow build, and you're right. It's going underappreciated because it's not Harper Machado. It's not spend hundreds of millions to get these top three guys. You know, the biggest move they made was getting James Paxton from Seattle. It happened
Absolutely.
Very early in the off season, and so it's gotten kind of lost. And he's also not viewed by a more casual fan as, you know, your Kershaw, Verlander, Scherzer type of ace. But there are so many people around the game who think this was a fabulous move by the Yankees to strike early and get James Paxton, who is trending up. His injury history has been mostly of the freak injury variety, not chronic elbow, shoulder type things. And, you know, I can't tell you, Steve, how many people I talked to over the winter that are always, and this is people from around baseball, you know, who always tell me that, you know, Brian Cashman is really good at his job despite being able to throw a lot of money at problems. And when you look at Paxton, that's another classic example of the type of move that people love about it. It's going to take a while for that to really show itself. But Luis Severino, if he's ready to really make that next step, he's already one of the top 10 pitchers in the game. If he's ready to jump into being the top five or six guys, you know, you can see where the Yankees' slow build the last couple of years might end up, you know, getting them over the hump and getting them over the Red Sox. You know, that's the thing that I think has bothered most Yankee fans that I know or deal with on social media or whatever. It's that Harper and Machado, they believe, could be the guys who definitively put the Yankees over the top and crush the Red Sox before the season even starts. Well, and this is where the Red Sox are really good. You know, they were great last year, and they're still really good. You're not going to make any move that's going to crush them before the season starts. You got to put your best team out there and play out 162, and just like you always do, and see what happens. I think their infield is a little shaky because of, you know, Tulowitzki. You're counting on a guy bouncing back after missing an entire year, and you're one injury away from an infield that isn't your best, defensively not your best. So I'm a little worried about that, and I do see that, you know, you got a couple of and ifs in your rotation, but overall still a good rotation, really good lineup with maybe some bounce backs from some other players, namely Gary Sanchez, and maybe Aaron Judge doesn't get hit by a pitch and miss 7 weeks. This all helps your offense. They're a really good team, and I don't ever like making the predictions every year of how many wins are going to get, who's going to win the division.
Right.
You know, all I want to say, Steve, when I get to the opening day and say, do I think this team is good enough to win 95 to 100 games?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I do. Last year, I did. And the rest of it's, you know, the rest of it's just guessing. So why, you know, to me, that's not worth it. Are they good enough to make a run? Yes.
Yeah.
That's all I can tell you.
Always a pleasure. Love talking baseball or anything with you. Great to talk with you again, Sweeney.
Steve, you're one of my favorites, one of my early mentors, and thank you so much for your kindness over the years and all the kind words and the build-up. So pleasure to join you and all the fans in State College. I still consider it home and, or, you know, a piece of home. So hi to everybody out there, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, my friend. Great to hear you. Always doing great work. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.